Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 22nd, 2014. A lone gunman conducted an assault on Canada's Parliament in the capital city of Ottawa today. They didn't take him alive. Canada's capital and the Parliament complex were the scene of an attack, an assault that is already being blamed on terrorism, even though we have no information at this point about the attacker. And the New York Times, in its second paragraph of the story, acknowledges, while the motive was unclear, the Ottawa attack heightened fears that Canada had been targeted in an organized terrorist plot. Now, I don't have any more information than you do, and certainly this is going to be the subject of a media swarm over the next few days, and we'll find out much more. But initially, I'm skeptical. And I am concerned that we are seeing that predictions that were made by American and other elected officials, that the Islamic State would send fighters back to their home countries to conduct terrorist attacks, or would somehow recruit so-called lone wolves to conduct these types of attacks? Well, I will await the evidence before we jump to any hasty conclusions. Now, Canada raised its terror threat level last Friday, so perhaps they had intelligence that something like this was possible. But my skepticism comes from the recent events in September in Australia, where a group of alleged terrorists conducted an attempted attack, and then the conservative government there passed a whole spate of new police state laws. And with the conservative government of Stephen Harper in Canada, I consider this to be a possible response. And that's why I will withhold judgment and remain skeptical about this particular event and the one that happened yesterday in Montreal. Now, those who don't know the geography, I've spent a little time in eastern Canada. Ottawa is in the province of Ontario, and Montreal is nearby, but about a two-hour drive in Quebec. And yesterday, a Canadian man was shot dead by police after running over and killing. He ran down two soldiers, killing one. And he is already described as a depressed conspiracy theorist who had recently become influenced by radical Islam. Now again, I await full investigation to understand the motive and the background attributed to this Canadian. His name is Martin Couture Rouleau. He is from the town of Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu in Quebec. And he was shot dead at the end of a high-speed chase near Montreal. He had struck two members of the Canadian Armed Forces with his car at a parking lot about 26 miles southeast of Montreal, and then he fled the scene. One of the soldiers who was hit died of his injuries hours after the attack. The other was less seriously wounded. Now comes an unnamed source who's described as a close friend who didn't want to be named, who told the Toronto Star, "It was a terrorist attack, and Martin died like he wanted to. He wanted to be a martyr." Now, this may be true. But again, I'm highly suspicious when here this guy is dead, but the person described as a friend who wants to remain anonymous isn't willing to give his or her name. This leads to skepticism that this could be some sort of a plant. And a week from now, I may eat these words. It may become very clear that Martin Rouleau was influenced by messages that he got over the internet from jihadist groups like the Islamic State. But these events and the way they're being presented in the corporate media strike me as too pat to packaged. And we shall see. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, there was a similar attack, similar to the one in Montreal or near Montreal yesterday. And this is a case of a driver who reportedly took his Volkswagen vehicle and intentionally drove off-road and into a group of people who were standing on a light railway platform. A 3-month-old baby was killed. 8 other people were wounded in this event. Now, again, my suspicions, my hackles, my bullshit detector go into full alert because the Israeli government has already said that they know who this guy is and that they flatly say he is a member of Hamas. And therefore, they're declaring, with little evidence presented so far, that this is a terrorist attack. Benjamin Netanyahu, who never waits to attack the Palestinians, immediately blamed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, accusing him of incitement to an attack on Jews in Jerusalem. Now, Netanyahu was referring to a comment that Abbas made last week to Palestinians to use any means to prevent Israeli settlers from accessing the Temple Mount. Now, we can't isolate these events from the anger that builds up over Israel's continuing expansion of illegal settlements on Palestinian land, including in contested areas of Jerusalem. Now, the Guardian newspaper brings us this account. Details are sketchy. Police said the suspect, they said the suspect in the incident is what is known as a so-called runover attack. Now, this comes on the heels of a report the day before that in Jerusalem there was a conflict between ultra-Orthodox Jews and, I guess, liberal or less Orthodox Jews. And this relates to who can pray at the Western Wall. The ultra-Orthodox say that men should pray there and that women should not mingle with the men and they can pray at a shrine nearby. But there's a group of activists called Women of the Wall, and they've been placing ads on the side of buses in Jerusalem, calling on gender equality. And if boys can have their bar mitzvahs at the Western Wall, the Women of the Wall believe that girls should be able to have their bat mitzvahs at the Western Wall. So it's unclear if those protests, which turned into a bit of a mini riot, had any linkage to the alleged runover crime that has been pinned on a Palestinian man. And from there, the entire Palestinian nation and the entire Hamas group is blamed. And we saw earlier this summer when the 3 Israeli teenagers were kidnapped, that Netanyahu and others in his government flatly stated that it was the responsibility of Hamas. And we know that's not true. We also know that Netanyahu deceived the public, both in Israel and abroad, for 18 days while they claimed to be searching for those missing teenagers, and there was clear evidence that they were already dead. In another case in Israel, a prominent Palestinian activist from the West Bank town of Bilin has been convicted of obstructing Israeli military activity. His name is Abdullah Abu Rameh. He was found guilty of obstructing military operations in May 2012 during a rally that he led in support of Palestinian political prisoners who were hunger striking. He was arrested after standing in front of a bulldozer, preventing its operator from constructing a structure that Abu Rahman says Israeli soldiers plan to use to monitor and shoot at Palestinians. Abu Rahman told Al Jazeera on Tuesday, "They said I was standing in front of the bulldozer and didn't allow them to continue their work. For this, the court said yesterday that I'm guilty, and on December 1, they will give me the punishment." Now, you may recall the town of Bilin. About a year, well, it's almost 2 years ago now, there was a short film, a documentary, released called Five Broken Cameras. The filmmaker was Imad Bernat, and we interviewed his brother, Iyad Bernat, when he came through the United States. Five Broken Cameras was a finalist in the Oscar nominations for documentary film in, I believe, 2012. And this brought attention to the town of Bilin, where they have nonviolent protests against the Israeli separation wall and similar issues on a regular basis. And their nonviolent protest has drawn the attention of world leaders, including the director of foreign policy at the European Union, Catherine Ashton, who called Abu Rameh a human rights defender and criticized Israel in the past for convicting him on charges of incitement and organizing illegal demonstrations. Here in the United States, we've been following the sordid case of a federal judge from Alabama named Mark Fuller. And we've identified Mark Fuller as a bad egg for a long time. He presided over the trial that railroaded Don Siegelman into federal prison, where he remains. And last summer, this past summer, Mark Fuller was spending the weekend with his new wife, and they were staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. And the new wife called 911 and said that her husband, the judge, had committed crimes of domestic violence, and she detailed them. Well, Mark Fuller continues to hold a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. He's not currently hearing cases because his colleagues have sidelined him, and he took a plea bargain, which will cause him to do some sort of counseling over domestic violence and other issues, but he has so far refused to resign from his job. So yesterday, Alabama's Democratic U.S. Congresswoman, Representative Terry Sewell, says that if Fuller doesn't resign by November 12th, she's going to introduce impeachment proceedings against the judge in the U.S. House of Representatives. Quote, Judge Fuller's high-profile position does not shield his victim from the emotional and physical violence he inflicts upon her, and any legal immunity he's granted is a violation of justice. There's no treatment or counseling program that can resurrect what Judge Fuller has compromised as one who sits in the judgment of others. Sewell continued, I can't battle violence against women while turning a blind eye to Judge Fuller. Should he not resign prior to Congress return to Washington on November 12th, I will institute impeachment proceedings. This process will be long, it will be daunting. But even more daunting is the crisis of domestic violence. Also, the media group called Alabama Media Group, their website is al.com, has achieved success in a legal motion they filed to have the 2012 divorce documents that were sealed related to Fuller's divorce from his first wife are now available for public inspection. Now, we haven't seen them yet, but our friend and colleague Roger Schuler published detailed excerpts from the divorce documents of the Fuller divorce proceedings. And one of the elements of divorce in Alabama is that through the process, you can pose questions to your former spouse. And in that process, Lisa Fuller's lawyer submitted questions about whether Mark Fuller had abused drugs, had abused alcohol, and was guilty of domestic violence against his wife, his soon-to-be ex-wife, and their children. And this is very critical information that should never have been sealed. And it shows that in Alabama, judges are treated different from regular people. And this goes to the heart of the corruption that Roger Schuler has reported at the Legal Schnauzer blog for many years, and that led a year ago this month to his incarceration for 5 months behind bogus charges of contempt of court. And they effectively forced him to take down postings on his website that had been found embarrassing by Rob Riley, the son of a former Republican governor, who benefited from the railroading of Don Siegelman into federal prison. Both the father and son benefited. And the allegations of lurid affairs conducted by a family values guy like Rob Riley led him to get a special judge in a kangaroo court, and there were bogus findings of defamation that led to this finding of contempt and the illegal incarceration of Roger Shuler in Alabama. In an in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Katha Pollitt, an outspoken columnist for The Nation magazine and the author of an important new book called Pro. And Katha Pollitt is unabashed, unflinching, unapologetic in her support for abortion rights. And unfortunately, that kind of outspoken support is becoming extremely rare in this country. In this excerpt from our detailed interview, Katha Pollitt explains why abortion rights are important, not only to pregnant women.
People don't realize that so much of the advances of women in the last 40 years are directly connected to broad availability of contraception and abortion backup, that the explosion of women in the professions into medicine, into law, into business, this would never have happened if women were living under the old regime of, if you want to advance in life, no sex for you until marriage.
Yeah.
You know, if you think of the way women used to live, there was a tremendous amount of dropping out of school, marrying it right after high school, if you didn't drop out of high school because you got pregnant, dropping out of college to get married, marrying in a shotgun marriage with the person who got you pregnant. That's not a happy story all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a kind of random way to choose your partner. But all of that together really held women back. People complain about, oh, yeah, the kids today, they don't want to settle down. Well, they settled down. They just settled down a little later. And abortion and birth control are part of that whole story.
Mm-hmm. You can hear the full interview with Katha Pollitt. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. You can also find it at iTunes, on Stitcher, and on the TuneIn platform. Another miscarriage of justice may have been rectified. Four former Blackwater security contractors were convicted Wednesday on charges stemming from a deadly 2007 shooting in Iraq. This would be the infamous Nisour Square shooting, which happened on September 16th in 2007. And these convictions were not easily achieved. Initially, the Iraqis wanted to try these four mercenaries in Iraq, and the U.S. government said no. And, reports the New York Times, Iraqis have been skeptical that a U.S. court would rule against Americans for shooting Iraqis. Their suspicions grew as the case suffered repeated setbacks, often of the government's own making. There was evidence that State Department officials had gathered shell casings after the shooting to try to protect Blackwater. Then State Department investigators gave the contractors limited immunity. In 2009, a judge threw out the charges, citing the Justice Department's mishandling of evidence, and an appeals court later reinstated the case. Despite that, the jury was out for, almost 2 months. They got the case in early September and finally returned their guilty verdicts, one murder, three manslaughter convictions of those four individuals. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And today I want to acknowledge a great letter from Colleen Van Neel, who lives in a suburb of Seattle. And she dropped in the mail a check for $100, she said, to use for the betterment of your radio show. And she tells me her sister, Eileen Weber, spurred me on to make this donation. She says, how can I let my older sister outdo me? She says, I listen to your podcast, and that she does it while she's working around the house, working in the garden, cleaning the house, ironing. And she has roots here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And she also recently saw the devastation of Mount Shasta by the drought that has led to the melting of its glaciers. And she also said, and I appreciate this comment, what I especially like about your program is how you interpret news in a different way. I listened to your podcast about Malala. This is the Pakistani girl who has won the Nobel Peace Prize. She said, when it was announced, it didn't set well with me and I couldn't figure out why. You gave me the reason I was searching for and clarified my feelings. Well, Colleen, thank you very much for the contribution. And thank you also for your kind words about what we do here. I'd like you to follow her example. Sign up for a subscription today. Come over to peterbcollins.com. Click the link that says sign up right under my picture. That'll take you to the page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers here in the continental U.S. get themselves a bonus CD. It's John Dist's Red Flag CD with a lot of great songs on it. Well, in Hong Kong, the protesters are shifting tactics, but they continue to put pressure on the pro-Beijing government there. And about 200 of the demonstrators marched to the home of the executive, the guy who is nominally the leader of Hong Kong. Of course, he's approved by Beijing and toadies up to them on a regular basis. So these 200 demonstrators went to his house, chanting slogans like shame on you. And part of that is in reaction to recent comments by C.Y. Leung, who said, gosh, you know, universal suffrage is going to mean that all those poor people will vote. And this is kind of his equivalent of Mitt Romney's 47% secret videotaped comments that were a real damper on his campaign in 2012. At about the same time the demonstrators went to Leung's house, they also continued to occupy streets in Mong Kok along Nathan Road, and there was a scuffle with a group of what appeared to be taxi drivers as they attempted to remove barricades blocking a major thoroughfare. But over at Leung's residence, police didn't interfere with the rally. They hovered on side streets in riot gear, but did not move in on the protesters. So it's very interesting to see that despite the effort to deflate the protesters, to take the wind out of their sails with this meeting with the number two that was broadcast on television the other night, the protesters know a sham democracy when they see it, and that's why they continue to take these actions. Now, curiously, Kenny G has showed up. Yeah, Kenny G, the smooth jazz sax player. He recently completed a tour in mainland China, and he dropped in at the Admiralty Occupy Zone in Hong Kong. I think that's in central on the island. And he tweeted, he said, I'm in Hong Kong at the site of the demonstration. I wish everyone a peaceful and positive conclusion to this situation. Apparently, the stylings of Kenny G are extremely popular in China, and I'm glad he's on the side of the protesters. Now to the update from the Middle East and the war zones in Syria and Iraq. The United Nations has warned that any further attacks on the Yazidi minority population by the fighters of the Islamic State could be tagged as attempted genocide. And of course, they're accused of slaughtering Yazidis in large numbers in recent months. And we were told that rescuing the Yazidis was the reason why the U.S. had to re-enter Iraq with airstrikes, which started in August. We're told that thousands of Yazidis are still stranded on Mount Sinjar, and I thought they had all been rescued and that situation had been resolved. But now we're told they're back, and this accusation of genocide might move forward. Now, we're also getting confirmation from U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, that one airdropped bundle that had been intended for the Kurdish fighters near the town of Kobani, or in that town, it fell in the wrong place and was picked up by enemy hands. And while the Pentagon comes just short of fully confirming it, it appears that what we reported to you yesterday is true. And this presents an opportunity for Turkish President Recep Erdogan to tweak the United States one more time. And as we've reported, Erdogan is a very unreliable ally of the United States. And yet he claims that Turkey is supporting the battle in Syria. He wants it to be against the Assad government, not against the Islamic State. Nonetheless, he reversed course on Monday and said that he will allow Kurdish fighters affiliated with the KPP, which is a group that's banned as a terrorist organization in Turkey, to transit through southern Turkey to the war zone near Kobani. And one more tweak from Erdogan. He says, I have difficulty understanding why Kobani is so strategic for the United States and the West, because there are no civilians there, just around 2,000 fighters. Well, I think that's a pretty silly statement. But it shows that Erdogan is kind of taking the place of Hamid Karzai as the alleged ally of the United States who loves to continue to poke Uncle Sam right in the eye. We're learning from a television station in Denver that three teenage girls left Denver Airport last Friday heading for Turkey on their way to Syria, and that they were responding to recruitment messages from the Islamic State. These three girls, all under the age of 18, grabbed their passport, grabbed $2,000 of cash from their parents, and hit the road. We're told that two of them are sisters of Somali descent, aged 15 and 17, and the third girl is from the Sudan and is described as a 16-year-old. And it's not clear if they're going to be charged with a crime, but the FBI intercepted them on their way to Turkey and returned them to the United States yesterday. Also, Denver was the scene back in August when Maureen Conley, 19 years old, of Arvada, Colorado, was arrested, April, not August, April 8th, after telling FBI agents that she was traveling to Syria to use her American military training from the U.S. Army to aid Islamic militants. She's been charged with conspiring to help a foreign terrorist organization, and she pleaded guilty last month. I guess Denver is a hotbed of Muslim activism. In the past week or so, we've gotten more information coming from the law enforcement side of the conflicting stories about the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, in August. And the news lately, including grand jury testimony by the officer who shot Brown and an autopsy report conducted by St. Louis County's medical examiner, don't tend to support the position of Michael Brown's supporters. According to the autopsy report, Brown's hand was wounded, and the wounds indicated that the shot may have come in a struggle for the police officer's weapon. Now, Darren Wilson was the cop who shot Brown on the 9th of August, and the evidence also shows that there were some tissue samples or blood from Michael Brown on the exterior of the police vehicle. And the St. Louis medical examiner says the evidence supports the notion that there was a significant altercation at the car. So the full story remains to be told, but at least the parts that are dribbling out tend to support the law enforcement version of events. Of course, all of the information is dribbling out from law enforcement, so consider the source. And finally today, as you may know, I was an early beneficiary of the Watergate scandal that brought down the presidency of Richard Nixon. I was a young talk show host in Chicago, and every night we covered the unraveling Watergate scandal. And it made me quite successful. The management of my radio station was shocked that suddenly I was getting these big ratings. And it's all because of Watergate. And one of the heroes of the journalistic enterprises that helped expose the crimes of Watergate and lead Richard Nixon into an early retirement came from the once great Washington Post. And the editor at the time, who supported the work of his investigative journalists who interviewed the guy named Deep Throat, that would be Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, Ben Bradley, passed away yesterday at the age of 93. He's been ailing and declining, but his legacy lives on. And as we discuss in this week's Processing Distortion podcast interview with Robert Perry, the Washington Post continues to soil itself. Most recently, as one of its editors, the guy in charge of investigation, went out of his way to piss on the grave of Gary Webb. And in the Processing Distortion interview, we talk at length with Bob Perry, one of the early reporters who broke the Iran-Contra story, about Gary Webb's reports that linked the Contra airplanes that ran guns south and cocaine north to the development of the crack epidemic in this country. And while the CIA denies that it was directly involved in the drug running, well, as I point out to Bob Perry in the interview, Gary Webb never alleged that the CIA controlled it. What he said in his detailed report called Dark Alliance was that the CIA knew that the contractors it was using to run the weapons to South America, to Nicaragua, were returning with plane loads of cocaine. And they did nothing about it. That's what Gary Webb actually reported. And when you hear the CIA and its proxies making these kinds of denials, denials of allegations that were never made, I hope you'll treat them with appropriate skepticism. And maybe in honor of Ben Bradley, you'll go out and see the movie Kill the Messenger. It's really well done. It's quite fact-based. And I think it is an accurate and honest portrayal of the work of the late Gary Webb. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.